the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Mark A. Vieira joins us this week. He's a photographer and a film historian, and he's written about Greta Garbo, and he was a co-author with Tony Curtis of a memoir on the film Some Like It Hot. And his latest book is Irving Thalberg, Boy Wonder to Producer Prince, an in-depth biography of the producer who guided Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer in the golden age of Hollywood. Mark A. Vieira, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you, Gary.
Well, Thalberg is such a fascinating person, and he died quite young. It almost seemed as though he always knew that he wouldn't live long. Is that so?
Well, I get the feeling that he was pushing himself because he wasn't sure. I mean, at times he seemed like he was in very good health, the blush of health, but yet there'd be these occasional, you know, kind of backslides into, I won't say invalidism, but he'd be warned in some way. And he did have two heart attacks, one at 26 and one at 33, so that's significant in itself.
Well, how did Irving Thalberg get into the film industry?
It was his grandmother, who was a neighbor of Carl Lemley in Edgemere, Long Island. And Lemley had a practice of running movies on his porch on a bed sheet or some kind of blanket or something. And the grandmother was hosting young Irving. I guess he would have been about 17 or 18 at that point, next door. And so they were invited to go and look at these movies. And young Irving made a kind of a very wise comment about one of the films. And Lemley's ears pricked up. But he didn't offer him a job. So Irving went to Manhattan and applied for a job formally without, you know, pulling any strings, just saying, oh, I know him from my grandmother's. He just went and applied for a job as secretary, and he got it because he had gone to business school. And because he wasn't strong enough to go to college, they had felt that the workload would be too difficult for his heart to sustain, you know, with cramming for exams and all that. But he was able to go to business school. He knew Spanish. He knew all kinds of what they called secretarial skills at that time. And he did it, you know, a good job as that. But more than that, what they realized, this is a young man who was ill for most of his childhood and read a great deal. And he's got an amazing vocabulary. He understands stories. And he just has a kind of a sponge-like brain. He just can assimilate all kinds of information and also come up with solutions for problems.
Was he more of a businessman or an idea man?
He was the odd blend. He was both. That's what makes him amazing, was that, you know, you have artists and you have business people. You know, for example, Mayer was a great businessman, a brilliant, you know, a managerial genius, Louis B. Mayer. But Thalberg understood business as well as he understood, you know, aesthetics, storytelling.
So Thalberg went to work for Carl Lemley, who was the head of Universal Studios.
Right, it was called Universal Film Manufacturing Company at that time.
Uh-huh.
But they had a studio here on a large plot of acreage in the Cahuenga Pass, and Lemley sent this kid, or brought him with him. You know, I think Thalberg was about 19 at that point, and they came out to here to look at how the film factory was doing, and it wasn't doing well at all because they had a bunch of executives who were squabbling and feather bedding and gold bricking and all those, you know, because no one was watching them. And so Lemley leaves this kid, this, you know, very slight, boyish-looking, you know, adolescent, leaves him in charge, goes back to New York, and Thalberg just goes ahead and fires these guys and reorganizes it according to his own liking. And he wasn't afraid of anything.
Including firing Eric von Stroheim? Is that when that occurred?
Yeah, that occurred several years later. But the idea that, you know, this a person who was barely 21 could stand up to these, you know, worldly wise executives and filmmakers and say, you know, I will do it my way or you leave. And in most cases, they had to leave.
So how did he end up with Louis B. Mayer on top of him?
Well, what happened was Lemley, this Universal was a real nepotistic place. Everyone who worked there virtually was a relative of Lemley's. And Lemley wanted Irving Thalberg, who had made the company much more profitable than it was and putting out quality films. No, that wasn't good enough for him. He wanted him to marry his daughter, Rosabelle. And interestingly enough, young Irving had been dating this girl, you know, kind of a spoiled girl. Not a nasty person, but, you know, a little childish, even though she had been raised. Her mother died in the influenza epidemic of 1918, so she'd raised herself and her brother. in New York. Anyhow, he didn't want to marry her because his mother said, you know, Thalberg's mother said, if you marry her, you're part of the Universal family. How would you ever be able to go to work for Fox Film Corporation or First National or Famous Players? You know, you're stuck in this company if you marry into it. And that company is only going to be so good. It's not going to be the biggest company in Hollywood. The mother could tell that. So he said, okay, I won't marry your daughter. And then the old man said, okay, then you don't get a raise. And it's amazing because he had really turned this company around. And this is the gratitude they showed him. Marry my daughter or no raise. So he left the company. He went to this little tiny company in the northeast part of Los Angeles, which was, you know, just in those days, everything was orchards and fields and stuff. This was where there was a zoo. The Selig Zoo was there. And on the premises of the zoo was this little studio called Louis B. Mayer Productions from Massachusetts. And so Thalberg went to work for them as a, you know, production manager, you know, bringing in stories and deciding what would be filmed and how to cast them and everything. And they did so well in 2 years that they caught the attention of Marcus Lowe, who had this theater chain of 100-something theaters all across the country. And he had the idea, why not put these guys in charge of the two companies that aren't doing so well, Goldwyn and Mayer, and make it all into one company on the Golden Lot, which is in Culver City. So that's how MGM came to be, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer.
Now, if Thalberg had stayed with Lemley, eventually Lemley's family lost control of Universal, and Universal made, you know, some prestige pictures, but mostly they made Abbott and Costello comedies and they made monster movies. Do you think they would have reached the heights that MGM reached if Irving Thalberg had stayed with them?
I think so, because he was a visionary. He had the ideas and he had the ways to implement them, and he also understood how the business worked. Yeah, I think you're right about this. A very good point. I didn't bring it up in my book, but that's an excellent point.
So now at MGM, the new studio, controlled by the bank, but run by Louis B. Mayer and Irving Thalberg. Irving Thalberg was head of production and Louis B. Mayer was head of the studio. Is that how it worked?
Yes, he managed the studio, the physical plant, and hired people. But also, you know, Mayer was a wonderful talent scout. He really had a sense for people's abilities and potential. So he found Greta Garbo, for example. One of his people found Joan Crawford. But he was always finding people, and then it was up to Thalberg to find a formula to make that person a star.
Now, I don't want to get too far ahead of the story, but Louis B. Mayer at one time loved Thalberg and thought of Thalberg as his, you know, like his son, and then eventually came to not like him very much.
That's true. When they first met, Mayer was in his late 30s, Thalberg was in his early 20s. Mayer was not really old enough to be his father, but there was a feeling of, this is my son. The son, you know, I have two daughters, but I always wanted a son. Here's the son I never had. And, you know, they complemented one another so wonderfully in that Thalberg was a little, you know, studious, professorial, very very reserved, almost cool. Mayer was effusive and noisy and dramatic and emotional and expansive. And they were a great team. And they really did respect and care for each other very, very deeply from the time they started to work together, you know, in the spring of 23. And it was a great partnership. I think without that partnership, there wouldn't have been an MGM that becoming within 2 years, the 2.5 years, I should say, the most powerful company in Hollywood and really ultimately the most successful studio in the history of the industry in the world.
Well, you know, we're speaking with Mark Vieira, if you're just joining us, and his latest book is Irving Thalberg, Boy Wonder to Producer Prince. And, you know, looking at the list that you've published in the back of the book of all of Thalberg's films, you know, people like you and me who love silent movies and are, you know, film historians or whatever, you know, we love these movies, but a lot of these movies are pretty forgotten today.
Well, on the one hand, you can say that about the silent films, but on the other hand, try and see a film made at Universal in the 20s or 30s. Try and see a film made at Paramount in the 20s or 30s. But if you want to see a film made at MGM, even in the 20s, just turn to Classic Movies, and there it is, in good condition. And it's wonderful. They've been doing a lot of the silent films, you know, having people write scores for them.
Yeah.
For example, The Torrent, Garbo's first film, is going to be on, I believe, later this month, early next month, on TCM. It's a beautiful preservation that they did, restoration, and a new score. But to me, there's forgotten, yes, but I mean, you can say the same thing about a record from 1965 or a car from 1972. I mean, our culture eats things up as faster than it makes them. But what's to me fascinating about these films is that there exists, fortunately, a way we can see them. And when you see a film like The Good Earth, whose star is going to be 100 tomorrow, is Louise Reiner, that film still really gets you in the throat. I mean, it's so powerful. There are so many really affecting scenes in it. It's a work of art that still has power and still has relevance.
Yeah, I think people, modern audiences, are jarred when Jewish actors are portraying Asians in The Good Earth.
Well, there was a controversy about that too at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not merely a politically correct issue. It was an issue at that time. People said, no, that you shouldn't do that.
Uh-huh.
And he said, I think that the humanness of the story will transcend that.
Which it does, of course.
Yeah.
But why did he not use Asians in the film?
Because there was nobody who had a star presence. Even Anna May Wong, who has a huge following now, as I'm sure you might be aware, just was not an accomplished actress. She couldn't do line readings so that would have been believable in the story, unfortunately. There was nobody who really was, of that magnitude of a personality. You know, they could have discovered somebody, but it would be taking a huge chance on a film that was terribly expensive.
Well, I think probably the film of Irving Thalberg's that most people have seen is The Night at the Opera, the Marx Brothers film. I may be wrong about that, but that's one I think that's...
That's a good... It's very hard to say. Would it be Grand Hotel or Mutiny on the Bounty or... But
Camille.
Yeah, you're right. It's the films when he became an independent producer at MGM and he came back from his momentary exile. Yeah, those films really do hold up.
Well, let's take a film like Grand Hotel, which is for those listeners who might not have ever seen Grand Hotel. It's a marvelous story. I think it's probably the first all-star film ever made.
Yes, because up to that time, the rule was one star, it can carry one film. That's it. You don't put more than one star in a film, it's a waste of money. But this was the worst year of the Depression, the worst period of the Depression, and he took a chance on putting five, not two, five in one movie.
And they're all great in it.
Yeah, and the roles were so well balanced, and it paid off so handsomely, but if you read in the book, that there were so many story conferences to figure out how they were going to balance those roles and make everybody, each star have the exact right inflection, but also enough screen time to justify this huge gamble that they were taking.
So what role in that picture, how talk us through it. How would Thalberg make that picture?
Well, first of all, he knew that there was this novel, and he knew that someone wanted to put a play of it on in New York, so he had MGM be the angel for the producer in New York, the theatrical producer. And they put the play on. The play was a success, so they already have a pre-sold property. So then they start to make a movie of it. Everybody says, oh, great, Grand Hotel, that's terrific. So then the next thing he does is, how is that play going to translate to a screen? And so they start putting in cinematic devices, opening it up. But what he was wise in not doing was he didn't take the story outside of the hotel. So this is one of the first stories that really limits itself to, like, Shanghai Express is on a train or Titanic is on a ship. This limits itself to the hotel. You never see the characters outside of the hotel. Their backstories, are explained, but you don't ever see them outside of this closed environment. And the environment is what propels a story and becomes a character in the story as much as any of these five main characters.
And that was one of Thalberg's ideas?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. That was his idea, to keep it enclosed, like hermetically sealed.
And how about the casting? Was he responsible for that?
Yeah, because initially it was going to be John Gilbert, Clark Gable, Buster Keaton, Garbo, and Crawford. And he said...
What role would Keaton have played?
Kringlein, the mortally ill accountant.
Interesting.
So,
the part played by Lionel Barrymore.
So he had the idea, if we get two Barrymores in the one film, but the part of it was he wanted to get Ethel Barrymore for something else, so he thought, I'll persuade her by making them in a second film and see how big a hit it'll be. And it worked. He got Ethel Barrymore for Rasputin and the Empress. But back to Grand Hotel, Clark Gable, during the period of these story conferences when they're hashing out the story, became a big star, and they couldn't put him in the part of the villain, the industrialist from the provinces. So they got Wallace Beery to play that part, which was a throwback to what he'd been doing in silent films, because he'd recently become a star on A Gamble by Thalberg as kind of a cranky old guy with a heart of gold with Marie Dressler. And so now he put him back as a villain, and it really was a great casting, because he's just it's etched an acid, that characterization in the Grand Hotel.
Yeah, yeah. And he's the only one who speaks in a dialect in the film.
Yeah, because he's from the provinces.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, because I remember I was in college, so why is that? So I said, I'm going to find out. So I asked Sam Marks, who was story editor at that time, and he said, oh, because Irving thought because he wasn't from Berlin.
That's interesting, because everyone else is just speaking perfect English, although they're assumed to be speaking German.
Yeah, it's all that mid-Atlantic accent that they were trained in at that time.
Joan Crawford, I think it's one of her great performances.
Yeah, that really established her as a star of the first rank. That just, and she was somebody that they had been grooming and grooming and grooming, and they just couldn't find the right part for her. And then she put her in Our Dancing Daughters, and all of a sudden, wow, it just clicked. It was that moment where a star is born because of the right time, the right age, the right look, the right role, and the right publicity.
People who think stage diving was invented by Pearl Jam fans have to see Our Dancing Daughters, where Joan throws herself off the stage into the arms of all the people.
Right, right.
That's great. Well, he made Irving Thalberg made so many great dramas, The Big Parade and The Crowd, and yet he made A Night at the Opera. How did he come to work with the Marx Brothers?
Well, he had a habit, shall we say. He liked his bridge games on Thursday night at his home. So you'd have people there like Constance Bennett, Samuel Goldwyn, the head of Goldwyn Films, and Chico Marx. And he heard from Chico, things aren't so good right now. I shouldn't be playing because, Paramount cut us loose, and we're kind of floating here and there. And so Thalberg says, well, let me meet with you and your brothers, and let's talk about something, about making a movie. And Groucho was not going for it. Groucho was kind of rude to him. They met at lunch at a hotel, the Beverly Wilshire, I think it was. And Groucho almost got up and left. He said, you don't think we're funny, do you? And he said, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that you need the backbone of a story to hang your funniness on. You'll meet a wider audience. He felt like women weren't going to see the Marx Brothers films because there was no romance and there was no a strong plot line. So, of course, they did that. They put a young couple, Kitty Carlisle and Alan Jones, in that film, Night at the Opera, and gave it a really strong story. But the main thing that made it work was that Thalberg said, we need to make fun of something. He says, you guys, they're anarchists, essentially. So we need to make fun of something that people don't make fun of. So obviously religion was out, since the production code was very powerful at that point. So they chose the opera. Again, Thalberg and Mayer were both patrons of the Los Angeles Opera. So he knew it firsthand.
So Irving Thalberg married Norma Shearer, one of the great stars of the day.
Norma Shearer, for years there was this apocryphal junk in books. Oh, well, she had no talent, and she only became a star because he married her. Well, it's not true. I mean, as I found out from looking at all these archival records and the profit and loss sheets and all that, she became a star. And in fact, it's in the L.A. Times and other magazines of the period. She became a star in December of 25 with a little funny comedy called His Secretary, where she played an ugly duckling who becomes the princess. So by the time they married, he'd been through a number of romances that didn't work out, and she just was waiting for him. And, she caught him, and he said to one of his secretaries, oh, I guess you never thought that I would let her get me, did you? And the woman just sort of chuckled, if only you knew how often I've seen her mooning after you in the office, just waiting for you just to catch your eye so you wouldn't forget about her. But yeah, it was, Norma was calculating, but she also was sincere. I mean, I do believe that, that she really did love him and he really did love her, and it was a happy marriage.
She was a fine actress, although I guess maybe because she retired, but, Betty Davis and Joan Crawford are kind of remembered really well, and Garbo.
But yeah, my theory is this, that if Thalberg had lived, there wouldn't have been the wholesale cutting loose of actresses in 41, 42, where you lost Jeanette MacDonald, Myrna Loy, Shearer, Crawford.
Garbo.
Garbo, and then, of course, Jean Harlow had died, so that's a moot point. But if Thalberg had lived, I think you would have seen an entirely different kind of constellation of stars in the 40s. You would have had the new ones, Lana Turner and all those people, but you would have seen Shearer and Garbo doing things like Crawford did with Humoresque, Mildred Pierce. I mean, finding a whole new audience and finding a whole new kind of material. That was just a total waste to lose Garbo and Shearer at the same time, because they had many years left in their careers.
I think people think that Garbo walked away intentionally, but she was definitely looking for more pictures.
She was, and there was no guidance. The only producer who cared about her was Bernard Hyman, and he died of a heart attack just as they were about to do her the film after the one that didn't do so well, which, as it turns out from the records, it didn't do as badly as people have said all these years, The Two-Faced Woman. But, yeah, Garbo needed guidance. Shearer definitely needed guidance, and the rest of them, Myrna Loy, they always had... All those people had years left in their careers that were wasted because there wasn't somebody who really had a vision for them.
Well, I noticed that one of the top money-making pictures that Irving Thalberg made was The Broadway Melody, which is really not even watchable.
I know. The songs are wonderful, but, oh boy, that early talkies technique. And I get into this, too, and I do take them to task, and I say, Paramount, for example, in the early talkies, they were using one camera and then doing it like you do... When you do your coverage, you do the wide shot, then you do the over the shoulders, and you do your other, your cutaways and so forth. He insisted upon having three cameras, the one for the wide shot and one over. You couldn't go over the shoulders, so it's at a slight angle. And the result is about 2.5-3 years of movies that just don't move because they're locked into that three camera. It's almost like the early Lucy shows are the same thing, and a lot of the sitcoms for over years since have that three camera. And it just doesn't allow for real spontaneity, mobility, fluidity, or true cinematic quality. It's stilted and doesn't feel right. And that caused problems for a couple of years. And you're right that that film and many like it just kind of lay there because of that problem. But once they got away from that in late 31, early 32, boy, those movies really move. I mean, his films in 32 is probably more impressive than what he did. When he was a producer on his own, because there's such a variety of material in 1932 at MGM that's just amazing, the stuff that they shot. Freaks, Congo, Skyscraper Souls, Faithless, Red Dust, Grand Hotel, all these different vehicles, very adventurous kind of material, very, very offbeat subject matter, like there's one about a lobbyist who seduces a senator. There's one about the stock manipulation, Skyscraper Souls. Mm-hmm. Just some great stuff that, very mature material, too. I mean, it wasn't, like trying to go to the 14-year-olds and say, you should see this movie. This is, Thalberg really believed in bringing people up to the material instead of pandering. That's what differentiated him from a great many producers then and now.
He made very literate films.
Yeah. I mean, he loves the stage plays, and he loved literature because he as a child, he was a voracious reader.
Some of his films appear to be literate, like The Prisoner of Zenda, maybe, but maybe they're not quite.
Well, no, that's Selznick.
Selznick, right.
So. Yeah, but Selznick, by the same token, loved his Dickens and all those,
right,
bona fide classics. But yeah, Thalberg. Well, look at the one that he was doing when he left Universal, The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Oh, uh-huh.
And he had planned to remake that with Charles Laughton, because Laughton was under personal contract to him.
Well, was Selznick kind of a thorn in Irving Thalberg?
Yeah, you would think that they brought him in to kind of peak Thalberg and said, here's your successor. But no, they got along well, and indeed Thalberg and Shearer put money into Selznick's company when he left MGM to go on his own to form the company that would ultimately make Gone with the Wind.
So how did Thalberg have a falling out then with Mayer?
Thalberg's friend and advisor committed suicide. This was Paul Byrne.
He was the husband of
Jean Harlow.
Yeah. What was that suicide all about? Do we know?
He had been having psychotic episodes for a while, and it just finally, he finally killed himself. It didn't help that he was married to a 21-year-old sex symbol. He was 42 and had, I won't say he was impotent, but there were problems. That was part of it. But also just he was under a lot of stress, and there was a history of mental illness in his family. So this caused Thalberg to, in this very, productive but difficult year, because MGM was the only studio making a profit in the worst year of the Depression, it caused Thalberg to step back and say, why am I working so hard when I have a damaged heart? I'm not respected, I'm not getting enough money for what I do from either Mayer or, from the company here or from the parent company, Lowe's. So he just told me he was going to leave, and so they threw more money at him, but they realized he doesn't want more money, he wants more control, and that's what we're not going to give him that ever. So they just kind of bided their time, and he had a heart attack from overwork in December 32, and they pulled the rug out from underneath him and said, we're eliminating your position, and, if you want to come back, you can't come back as head of vice president, you have to come back as an independent producer.
And was he upset about that?
Oh yeah, he it was treachery, and he knew that, but he also wanted to continue making a certain kind of film, and he couldn't do that at United Artists. He couldn't do it at Paramount. He wouldn't have the access to the stars he wanted at the other companies. So he chose to come back in this greatly diminished position, but he surpassed everyone's expectations of making great movies with this one independent production unit. Mutiny on the Bounty, Barrett's of Wimple Street, The Good Earth, all those films.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Mutiny on the Bounty. Was Mutiny on the Bounty made entirely at MGM?
Yeah, they had. They did send a crew to Tahiti to take pictures of a beach and natives running on the beach. But that was, for some rear projection shots and for sort of, cutaways and stuff. But the majority was done at Catalina. They built an island at Catalina, and also they built Portsmouth Harbor at Catalina Island on the isthmus. And then the rest of it was done just right in Culver City.
It's a brilliant film. I think it holds up incredibly well.
And they were, they didn't want it to make it. They said, who's going to see a movie with a bunch of men on a ship? Who cares? it's too brutal. It's too ugly. Who wants to see that? And it was a big moneymaker.
Weren't all the actors in it nominated? I think everybody was nominated for Best Actor that year.
I think French Ratone was too. But, that's a case where they said, you shouldn't do this. Then, of course, they said, you can't make The Good Earth. Who wants to see a movie about farmers in China? And they said about Romeo and Juliet, people don't understand Shakespeare. Who's going to see that? And the odd thing is that both films made a lot of money.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, both films cost so much that they couldn't break even.
Huh.
Yeah.
The Good Earth cost more than the amount that it brought in?
Oh, it was terrible. I mean, it was one of the top three grossers in 37. And yet, there was no way it ever made money. I think it was reissued in the 40s, 50s, and it did finally make its money back, as did a lot of their films that were reissued. But it was a not a problem, but it was the quote-unquote prestige picture, the one that makes the company look good, wins awards, but doesn't make its money back because it costs so much to make.
And I guess he probably never saw it.
No, I think he saw Rushes, but he never even saw a rough cut. In September they had just, just stopped shooting.
The book is called Irving Thalberg, Boy Wonder to Producer Prince. And we just started talking about it, and now we're out of time. But Mark Vieira, thank you so much for being with us this week on From the Bookshelf, and I hope you'll come back and talk Irving Thalberg some more when the book comes out in paperback.
Oh, thank you, Gary. I will do that.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll join us again next week for another great program. Check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook or iTunes. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne, and thanks to Mark A. Vieira, author of Irving Thalberg, Boy Wonder to Producer Prince, for being our guest this week. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.